Welcome to The Ether. Today is Friday, March 11th, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the Lunatic community. Take advantage of their Terra Luna Intel report on Telegram, which brings you the hottest news and updates on all things Terra each and every day. Find it using the link in the show notes. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, part two of a two-part space, The World is Burning and So is Luna, hosted by Through the Looking Glass. Let's take a listen.
I'll throw my...
You know Handshake Bond?
No, I don't.
It's pretty interesting. Basically gives you the ability to purchase like root level domains. So, you know, I can buy like .ttlg. I don't know. I mean, it's pretty interesting. It's kind of, you know, paused out at like 17 cents or something, but you know, structurally it's pretty interesting. Seffy, any thoughts on Handshake?
Hey guys. I just sort of showed up, so I'm not really sure what the conversations revolving around, but what does Handshake do? Sorry.
Yeah, so it's the ticker's HNS, but it's basically a service where you can bid on root level domains, the goal is to, you know, like when root level domains, like, you know, obviously first came on, certain people were or certain companies got the licenses to sell .com, .org, and, you know, all those types of things. And, you know, Handshake's goal is to disrupt that a bit. You know, you could buy .sefi, right? I don't know. It's an interesting idea to consider, the disruption of, you know, things like GoDaddy and Namecheap and all those guys.
Oh, I see. Looked into that at all. I'm not sure what their business model, whatever, is.
Yeah, like the string that it was pulling on that was pretty interesting to me was just specificity generally, right? Like the idea that, you know, as you have more users and more devices and, you know, just more addresses that are needed from a more complex internet, the idea of just, you know, being able to unlock access to root level domains was like a pretty interesting idea. You know, I've heard a couple people shill it a bit, it hasn't gotten, you know, a ton of traction.
Is it a stock ticker or a crypto ticker?
It's a crypto ticker. HNS.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he says ticker, but he's actually referring to, yeah, the crypto symbol.
Yeah. So anyway, we were just
interesting.
We were waxing a little bit, Seffy, on our conversation that we had with you the other day, just about, you know, the title of the room is The World is Burning and So is Luna. And so one of the things that we were kind of waxing on here a bit is, you know, what's your bet? The world becomes more or less chaotic in the next, you know, in the next decade. And then from that initial assumption, you know, the idea of, to the extent that blockchains are really fantastic, you know, orchestration, you know, tools for organizing and orchestrating, you know, activity across complex systems. It just is really interesting to consider that at any given time, there's more stability in some places and less stability in others. And so the idea of being able to like extend that, you know, that stability into chaotic hotspots is something that's interesting to think about. So we were waxing a little bit of philosophy there.
Interesting. By the way, can you hear me okay? Or is the mic going crazy again?
Now you're in.
Okay, cool. Because sometimes the folks up on the co-hosts and speakers like can't hear each other. Well, I was just on the call a little bit with, you know, Raul Paul with Real Vision here before I jumped on. And, uh-huh. You know, some of this was what they were kind of covering as far as, you know, global instability and, you know, the different effects it's going to have at this point. And basically he did, by the way, plug Terra, which is fascinating.
What did he say?
Well, he and Remy are obviously in the same sort of team there. And Remy sort of given him the Luna pill. But, you know, he kind of mentioned, you know, how a vast majority of the crypto space is, you know, basically nonsense. But there are a few sort of bright lights, you know, in the room. And these, you know, few things are going to pretty much like dominate the universe of adoption. And so, you know, he just sort of plugged Terra as that shining example or whatever. So that's kind of cool. He didn't really go into it that much. And there's like a gajillion people in the room and, you know, trying to get called upon to speak is probably difficult. But anyway, he did plug it a little bit. So that's kind of cool. But to your point, what's that? Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, well, I'd love to pull on that string a little bit. I mean, one of the things that we were talking about before you hopped in here was, you know, this idea that like, I mean, I don't mean to seem naive here. So maybe there is a recognition of what I'm getting ready to say, and it's just like the value is still building. But like, you know, Terra generally as a just like transaction and kind of like settlement rail, you know, it's like, it's really, I mean, it can't be overstated how special this ecosystem is. And it's like, you know, when we see things like, you know, clear linkages, which we talked a little bit with you the other day on the episode that you were on TTLG, but like clear linkages being, you know, kind of drawn, you know, at first with this, you know, LFG, you know, reserve mechanism. But then it's like, we kind of step that forward a little bit. And it's like, thinking about like technological linkages where you're able to, you know, transact on this Terra rail globally, but then you're able to like easily have access to, you know, the greatest store of value, I guess, in the ecosystem at current market cap, speaking in terms of market cap, is Bitcoin. So, you know, being able to like, you know, transact on Terra rails and then have access to something like Bitcoin in a super chaotic world, just a really interesting idea. And the punchline there is like, if you're Russian or Ukrainian right now, you're fucked, right? Like, I mean, you know, you may be completely against, you know, what's happening in Russia, but that doesn't change the fact that, you know, Visa's pulled, MasterCard's pulled, nobody wants to do business with Russia. And like, you just don't have, you know, the optionality is just not there. So would love for you to pull on that string a little bit.
Yeah. The butterfly effect of what all has occurred in the East there really can't be understated, obviously. I think there'll be repercussions and butterfly effects for years and years to come. You know, as it was already standing, you know, Russia was basically a sort of empire in collapse to a large extent. You know, besides their nuclear arsenal, their true military power is essentially nominal at this point. you know, people talk about, you know, what if they, you know, use nuclear weapons and this and that. I mean, like, you know, once you get to that sort of level, that's just mostly just a nonsensical discussion of the end of the world. So that's, it's not even a point in bothering, because we won't be there if that happens, and we don't have to worry about it too much. But assuming all else is equal, yeah, the financial repercussions of what's happening over there, as far as what Visa and MasterCard did, what SWIFT did, pretty much told every country in the world and telegraphed to anybody in the world that, well, you know, the our connection to SWIFT is not secure, and therefore we must do something else additionally, just in case the powers that be, or the Axis essentially decides to, or the Allies, or whichever one it might be, decides to cut us off from, you know, the system. So I think Mexico was saying something about Bitcoin lately again. There was some mention by, I think, Bitcoin News or somebody, that there's some talk about, you know, having it be a potential legal tender. And Terra essentially becomes just, once you've gotten the gateway of people into Bitcoin, you know, Terra becomes just the most natural next step, I think. But the way Raul sort of talked about it was, he was analyzing the value of the network based on essentially the, you know, total transactions on any given network, you know, which are the networks that have the most sort of volume and activity. And, you know, Terra was one of the ones that was pointed out there, which is basically true, in the sense that, like, if you look at any chart of Luna specifically, its volume in terms of traded activity just in Luna alone has been fairly consistently high for the last year, right? So you could sort of, like, you know, guess that we were going to have, like, price appreciation, transactional activities up. The total staked value, I think stakingrewards.com just posted as number one, or close to it, if not number one. And also the, what else happened? Oh, Astroport was like number two in the world in terms of exchange volume and such. So we're really seeing just huge, huge growth developments. This is why, like, you know, I've been sort of like loading up on, you know, Mars's token and like Astroport's token and all these things, like, while they're down, because these are the things that are going to kick ass over the long run in terms
by the way, volume. Astroport, speaking of Astroport, like, I just realized, like, I didn't even realize I got airdropped Astro. I think part of it could be because I don't know if it's that I'm in New York or the US, but, like, I went to the site today. Like, I just so happened to have a VPN on. I wasn't the first time I went to the Astro Dex, but this time I went and it was like showing me that I had $800 sitting there. And I was like, I thought it was a mistake.
No. Yeah. Like, Astroport had an airdrop for Luna Stakers.
Yeah.
Sure. For some reason. And for you, it didn't show up for some reason.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's like where I'm located or what, but I would say if it's not US people in the US, if anybody's in New York and they had it staked, or if they were supplying liquidity on, maybe on Apollo. I think that's what I did. I think I had stuff on Apollo. So
anyway, I guess to the discussion. What do you guys think? Like, as far as the sort of macroeconomic story driving crypto adoption. The question is that going to be, a real phenomenon, or is this crazy inflationary world with stagflation, where people don't have a lot of disposable income to play with, that might stifle investment into things? That's the big question.
So a couple of quick comments on that. One, I just want to circle back on, as macro as it gets, right? Like, the United States blocking Russia's access to their US dollar reserves is something that is pretty wild to think about, right? Like, I get it. I understand. I understand why the action was taken. But, like, truly, if you don't possess something, you don't own it. Like, that is a fact, right? And that's
that was a not your keys, not your Bitcoin situation.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I think that that's like something that you mentioned, just reverberating, you know, actions reverberating throughout the, you know, economy and larger cryptosphere. That's definitely one of them. I mean, that's like Canadian truckers on steroids, right? But then the other comment was, you know, I think that, like, we were talking about this maybe like 20 minutes ago or 30 minutes ago in the room, but I'll say it again real quickly. So it's like, you know, Bitcoin comes out in 08, and we see 21, 22 years of, you know, the longest bull market in the history of markets. And so the data around Bitcoin, like I remember in graduate school a few years ago, you know, I hopped in, you know, before Ethereum and after Bitcoin. And this was kind of what captured me and got me into crypto. Was I just started, you know, I was majoring in finance, and I was pulling down all the data that was available about Bitcoin. And like for this thesis project, I put together just this kind of, you know, explanation of Bitcoin and its kind of correlation along with, you know, within the context of precious metals, and then further contextualize against just, you know, world events that had happened. Now, that didn't mean shit at the time because, you know, there wasn't a lot of information that was out there. It was even harder to kind of collect and put it together. So all that is to say is, like, you know, in 2018, 2019, you just really started to hear people talk about Bitcoin as like a global risk asset, right? Which is interesting to think about, right? Because, like, when we think about, you know, global risk assets, like, one of the things that's very, very, very different about Bitcoin is, like, you know, let's say we all start a company and we grow it, and then, you know, our stock is on a public market, and then because our stock is on a public market, it's now available to more people. Well, Bitcoin is like the type of thing where, like, you don't need a huge market cap for this to be available to everyone, in so long as they have the internet. So, like, as we started thinking, you know, kind of financial talking heads started thinking about, you know, Bitcoin as a global risk asset, you know, the conversation quickly slid into, okay, well, it's high beta. And if it's high beta, then that means if the stock market takes a shit, like, it's going to take a bigger shit. That's, you know, how we think about beta. And so I think what's really, really, really interesting is, you know, over the past couple of weeks, you know, over the past couple of weeks, just in terms of the data points that are coming together around Bitcoin, like, in my mind, these are the most important data points, like, ever, right? Because there are global superpowers that are posturing and engaged in, like, kinetic war at scale. And that is, like, the nightmare scenario for markets. On top of that, we have this unbelievable monetary policy that's just, like, you know, unbound and out of control. You know, inflation is here to stay. It's like, transitory was a fucking joke. Everybody knew that, but now it's just kind of like, you know, it's complicated, right? And, like, and if we think about, like, truly, the Fed has no idea. Like, they, most people would say this, but, like, they have no idea simply based on, like, their ranking of, or not their ranking, but their categorization as to, like, how money hits the economy. They start with M1, they went to M2, they tried M3, which is, like, a more granular view of how capital moved around the economy. And then, you know, they ended up scrapping this M3 perspective because they were like, we have no fucking idea and we can't really figure out what's going on there. And so, like, all this is to say is that, like, and I guess the last data point here is gold has not been behaving as gold would have been expected to behave over the past, you know, over the past, I don't know, 2 years, probably. And so it's like, and still now,
well, part of that is too, is because it's not really clear how much of the how much gold is actually real. So
that's a great point.
Bitcoin's right. More verifiably real than paper gold is. That's a real question mark there.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Joseph, I'm gonna interrupt you. I got Cali Ivy in here. He's got a question. And Marty, if you're still in the spaces, go ahead and request to speak again. Sorry, I think you dropped off. But Cali Ivy, go ahead.
Oops, sorry there. I'm actually did not push the button. So sorry, I'll go back down now. Thank you.
So the punchline here is, like, and Seffi, if you've got more information around, like how the London gold markets work. You know, I think that would be super valuable to talk about that a little bit. But like, it is very unclear as to what, you know, what the gold markets actually look like. So all this is to say is that, you know, in the past, you know, the past, we'll call it month, we're getting just these really, really interesting data points around Bitcoin. And so, you know, on a long enough timeline, sure, you know, we see Luna obviously grow massively and become way, way, way more important to the crypto markets. But at current, you know, like all eyes are on Bitcoin. And so, you know, if Bitcoin, even relatively, right, holds at all through the next, you know, the coming months, I feel like that's like the starting gun for, you know, confirmation of a super cycle. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, all that has to happen to confirm sort of a super cycle would be this year a retest of prior Bitcoin high. You know, because the sawtooth pattern essentially of a super cycle behavior is that you still have the volatility, but you recover quicker from bearish markets. You know, over like a 10-year time frame, you just keep printing incrementally higher lows and higher highs. And that's what you'd like to see. So far, like right now, we're already at a higher low compared to last year, right? So doing pretty good thus far. And there's not really a lot of good reasons to believe that, you know, BTC is going to take some sort of massive dump. I just don't see it. There's no obvious reason to believe this. And as far as Luna's concerned, I think what we need to accomplish is we actually need to accomplish Luna's market cap ultimately becoming larger than ETH. And we have to accomplish UST's market cap surpassing Tether. Like both of those two things need to happen. And I think Doe understands this, which is why, you know, there's a mixture of things happening here. TFL funds locked up in Luna are being essentially converted to something to benefit the ecosystem at light speed. And one of those, of course, is the acquisition of Bitcoin reserves. And the other is to continually bolster the Anchor reserve with essentially what amounts to a UST airdrop, right? That's essentially what we're talking about when you're throwing free money into the Anchor reserve. And those two things are just meant to light speed, get UST into the hands of lots and lots of people, and simultaneously sort of catapult Luna as an investment grade asset. You know, and the combination of those two things, extraordinarily powerful, just given the size of the war chest for Terraform Labs. But yeah, the BTC market and the Luna market, I think, are going to essentially be, I would think, the bright stars over the next 2 years, like barring, you know, a massive amount of developer activity that sort of dominates other chains. You know, Solana's developer community is pretty large as well. I think they'll probably do okay. But the problem with most of the other layer ones right now is the inflationary tokenomics. So, like, just to give you an example of what I do with my Atom, like, okay, Atom has been flat, and the yield coming off of it in my Cosmos Station wallet is sort of sitting there. And if Luna's down, I don't have to restake that Atom. I can send it over and basically just buy myself some more Luna with it, right? You can just use their Kepler wallet, for example, and just like go to Osmosis and swap. And I get more Luna, I get more bonded Luna, and boom, now I like use my yields for buying the most like deflationary asset of them all. And I think what's going to continue to happen is that the more mature the large players in the crypto space, retail folks, I mean, most retail folks are just quite frankly clueless about what they're doing. That's a fact. That's just a fact. They don't understand the mechanics of it. They just sort of, you know, heard someone say something on YouTube or whatever, jump on. But the more like savvy buyers, you know, the smart money, the cap, you know, the venture funds, and all of these sort of big players that are savvy enough to spend hundreds of millions of dollars or more on assets, these folks are going to be looking for high quality, and they're looking for yield that the traditional markets are not providing them right now. And what's going to happen is that yields from other chains, like it's almost certain, are going to flow into Terra. The next evolution of that actually is coming very soon with, well, we keep saying soon and it's taking forever, but like Avalanche, bonded Avalanche, and you know, other forms of bonded assets where the yield is converted to UST and allow us to use it for other things, like, for example, buying Luna. So I suspect, you know, the way DAOs and such work, they accumulate lots of these different assets. And ultimately, they've got to figure out how to store their value from these various LP farms and inflationary yield Ponzinomics and whatnot, right? And they're going to take all of that yield, they're going to extract it, and they're going to throw it into the most, you know, wealth preserving versions of crypto, which would be right now things like Bitcoin and Luna. And this is going to be the perpetual problem of a significant portion of layer ones out there. Same thing is true, by the way, if you look at the behavior of the arbitrage bots across so many platforms, you know, Bitcoin pairs and such. Most people take their profit in Bitcoin or in USDT. They don't take their profit necessarily in the coin that they are arbing. They're just taking that volatility and stripping that liquidity and basically pouring it into what they consider a store of value. And that's why, like, all of the altcoin market essentially feeds BTC indirectly until it doesn't, where, like, for example, Luna makes more sense to own than Bitcoin from the perspective of growth, right? So the growth is going to be much, much higher. And in theory, you could take the yield from your Luna if you wanted to and buy BTC with it if you so chose. But it doesn't necessarily make sense to convert Luna to BTC because it is actually more deflationary for the time being. So that's kind of my thinking on sort of where the crypto space is going. It's going to be a flight to quality. Only the most useful and most deterministic price models are going to persist. And realistically, like, substantial portion, I would say, like, of the crypto, like, space today, I would say 99% of the various projects will go to literal zero, and with only a small fraction of the projects actually making it, and they'll take over almost all of the market cap at some point or the other. So it's almost inevitable that will happen, because you don't need like a dozen different forms of Bitcoin, for example. You just really only need one. You don't need a dozen forms of Luna. You probably just need one, right? Like, so, like, where's the need to have all these other versions of it?
Right. I just want to bring up a point. Obviously, next week, March 16th, we had the Fed meeting. Everybody's expecting a rate hike. We've talked about Bitcoin. And anybody that's listening, feel free to chime in. We'd love to get different perspectives here. I mean, how do you think Bitcoin and maybe even Luna were going to react? Let's say we get a quarter rate hike or even a half a percent rate hike. I mean, we look at equities, and I feel like equities have already priced in a quarter point hike. But I don't know if they've necessarily priced in a half a point. So what are your guys' perspectives on how that could pan out in Bitcoin and crypto in general?
I've never been really convinced that there's a major effect of macroeconomic anything in the crypto space. Like, you know, it's not heavy in the narrative. There's not a lot of heavy like price movement based on necessarily various announcements and such, outside of just sentiment driven sort of, like, you know, trading and such. But I'm not so sure there's a real correlation with any of those things, or that anyone really, really cares. Like, there's a constant, and this was mentioned again on Raul Paul's channel, you know, in the last hour, you know, someone made the comment that, okay, like, Bitcoin emerged with, you know, the 2008, you know, financial crisis, and therefore it had something to do with, you know, the worry of the Satoshi Nakamoto crowd of, you know, where that's going to be a solution for those kinds of problems. And I don't think so. Like, I think that was just most of that is coincidence. And the technology was where it needed to be, and video game theory was where it needed to be, and you know, Bitcoin, you know, it comes into existence. And then ever since then, every single movement of BTC, really since maybe about, like you said earlier, like 2018, 2019, everyone's trying to correlate it with some sort of like market condition. I don't know that the adoption is so exponential in crypto. I don't think you can correlate it to it, really. And it is coincidental, by the way, that the last, you know, 10, 12 years have been a massive, you know, sort of stock bull market. Fueled by inflation. But, you know, so we do need to see what crypto does in, like, let's say a serious recession or even a depression. We don't know what that looks like yet. So that would be the caution. But anyway.
Seppi, I got Marty back in here. I want to get
his. Hey, Marty, what's up?
He was actually in here before, so we got him back in here. And then, Nick, I'll get to you. So, Marty, let's go ahead. What do you got?
Yeah, I was going to speak to the macro aspect. If you go back and look in history, like in adoption and growth, early stages during the Great Depression, like RCA just did incredibly well because everybody just bought radios. If you take a look at Google, you know, they just made money. It didn't really matter what was going on in the macro environment because they were just growing, growing, growing. So I'm with Seffi here. It's like, you know, adoption and growth just doesn't affect. You know, the macroeconomic just doesn't affect these really high growth, successful projects.
Oh, and I would point out, if you guys look at XRP's price right now, it popped about 15%. You might say, well, why did that happen, given that, like, New York, the state of New York said that they're not going to be exempt from the lawsuit, and the lawsuit must continue. But, you know, the moment basically a whole lot of like XRP chatter starts happening on social media, what ends up happening is the price goes up because the social media based arbitrage bots just go into full like command mode. And, you know, you can just look up this stuff all over the place. Like, you can look it up on Lunar Crush, and you can look it up on APIs that connect to Twitter. And, you know, there's like literally just people just buy the sentiment, and that's it. Like, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden, like, the news has something specific to do with it, other than the fact that the news is sort of deterministic in a way, in that people react to it and robots react to it. But, you know, it should have gone the other way, right? Like, it should have gone down theoretically, but it didn't. So this is why, like, it's not a great idea to assign too much sort of correlation and like astrology to the whole thing. It's just, you're not going to really you're not going to be able to trade it that well. And that can be dangerous to people.
Right. Right. Nick, I believe you got a question. What do you got, man?
I was going to chime in on the comment around interest rates and how, you know, I think most of it's already baked in. I think with the inflation numbers that just came out, you know, I think everybody pretty much expects that there's going to be a rate hike. Now, you could flip a coin whether it's going to be a quarter versus 0.5. I think really what's more interesting is, you know, if the market starts to sustain, meaning the stock market sustains a fairly substantial correction, do people on the panel think that the Fed would step in? Because I heard this on a different space, that the Fed would potentially step in and start buying equities to keep the stock market from going into a big pullback, you know, because that's part of what sustains people's 401ks and their retirement plans and what have you. I'm just curious to see what people think about that.
So the one quick comment on that, and then I'll hand it over to Seffi here. But, you know, my bet would be probably they do. And the reason that I would say that is because, you know, as you pointed out, people's 401ks and these passive vehicles, right? So the number of just like zombie investments going into U.S. equities, like it's pretty insane, right? I mean, there's not a lot of price discovery that's been you know, kind of like, I mean, we used to step back and look at, you know, like markets are information engines. That's what they are, right? They're supposed to pull information and, you know, through them and decide what matters, and you know, and then theoretically, like all in caps, you know, capital should find its way to its best use. But it's like, you know, when you start adding up things like the amount of passive investing, people's like the risk that most people have who are just like working a job and sending money to a 401k and that money's being invested. I think that that's unclear to most people, just what their exposure is, you know, in this regime. So I don't know. Steffi, I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, what you're saying is basically that the normal price discovery of companies and what stocks are supposed to mean, they're supposed to imply like some relationship between how well the company's performing and the valuation of the stock should kind of correlate with that to some level or the other. And when you have index funds and you know, mutual funds and such, and they all tend to be in the same baskets, more or less by regulation and because of the market cap and the certain size of companies that qualify as a quote-unquote appropriate investments, what ends up happening is you get rid of the natural price discovery, and you have this massive amount of money just flowing into, you know, you just have massive amounts of money flowing into the equities market that are not necessarily tied to the performance of the company specifically. You know, famously the last year, if you just look at like what the price to earnings ratio of McDonald's is, it was like ridiculously high. It made no rational sense that, you know, McDonald's should be trading like a tech stock essentially. And these kinds of things happen when there are these just big market bubbles and such. And I think, as far as like, what can the Fed do if the prices start to fall? I don't know, like buy more like they've always done. It seems like there's only so many levers in their and options in their playbook as far as what can be done, and they've been doing everything they possibly can to sort of prevent the ship from kind of keeling over. And I guess it depends on whether you believe the Ray Dalio version of the universe, and where, you know, you have these basically crashing, you know, civilizations, and you know, we're going through a total sea change where we're at the sort of like the last generation lazy people that once our productive activity basically cannot keep up with the debt, which basically we're at already, then some sort of collapse has to occur. There's usually wars in between, and then some new hegemony or paradigm appears, which, you know, like if you look at his infographic, that in his mind is China, which I don't know that that's necessarily the case either. The big paradigm that I always keep sort of bringing up and is rarely talked about on, you know, television, financial news, the media, you name it, is the extreme white swan event impact of machine learning and how it's going to affect like middle class professional style jobs, not just like, okay, robots that, you know, put groceries in your bags or something. We're talking about, you know, the complete and total replacement of accountants and lots of other types of professionals in significant quantities. So there's a lot coming down the pike over the next, I guess, 15 years. And I don't know necessarily, I'm not even fully convinced that crypto is going to be the final store of value. One theory of mine, which I think will end up playing out, is that if you were to use energy and store value in something, right? Like, let's say Bitcoin. The one thing that can replace that in my mind is the power of thought, meaning machine learning computational power is a much, much more powerful reason to use lots of electricity and silicon. And that would, if you have essentially a cryptocurrency based system of you know, machine learning, then what you end up having is a complete displacement of sort of, you know, it's a surrogate marker, not only for the energy and the silicon that goes into it, but the sheer power of thought itself. And the primary utility of that network would be, you know, to provide machine learning computational capability, similar to how like Render gives you like, computational ability for rendering, you know, services. This would be the same concept, except you would power literally the power of thought. And, you know, you would pay out essentially a computational capability using this coin. And that, I think, will ultimately be the most valuable resource in the universe, like literally and figuratively in any way, shape, and form I can think of. And essentially, it's the moment that, you know, individual humans essentially become wholesale obsolete. And the number one store of value will be thought itself is kind of my like the long term view. So the number of kind of black swans that causes for human civilization makes all prior versions of like human enterprise, like war and economies and stocks and all the other bullshit that human beings talk about, to pale in comparison at such a level that like we just have no way of actually, we don't even have a way of really like even expressing how that's going to feel like or look like. It's that significant. I think Ray Kurzweil, you know, talks about it from the angle of like the singularity, things like that. But we're pretty close. Like we're in terms of computational technology, we're very close already. The only thing that hasn't happened is deployment at scale, which can be done. But like a lot of the companies that do this kind of thing are fairly rightfully so afraid of what unleashing these computational systems into the wild outside of specific sandbox is going to do to the planet right now. So, you know, so of all the conspiracies people worry about, like, I don't know, vaccines and fucking, you know, the CIA or whatever the fuck people think is, you know, their latest conspiracy. This is like, this basically dwarfs all of that stuff at a level that's incomprehensible.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, Seppi. I've expressed to the crew kind of behind the scenes that I'm of the mindset it's sort of the beginning of the end for the U.S. in a sense. I'm sure.
I'm not so sure about that.
I knew you'd be I'm going to cut you off because I want to bring on Spring Snow real quick and we'll get back to that.
Sure,
all right.
Sure. But the one caveat I would say is if you look at who has the greatest arsenal of machine learning computational capabilities right now, it is by far and away the United States.
Right.
So you are the amount of impact, if you unleash that shit onto the universe, would have is incomprehensible, to say the least. It's like imagine nuclear weapons, but on like steroids, because at least nuclear weapons.
I think that's what can destroy the US from within, right? Just that technology.
Maybe, but it, you know, he who controls the spice, right? as it were. For now, the United States controls the spice to a significant degree, believe it or not. And I think people underestimate that. Yeah. So I right, don't count out the U.S. of A just yet, is what I'm saying.
we'll circle back on this, but Spring Snow, what do you got, man?
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm outside and there's an alarm going off. So, as always, love just the diversity of ideas in these spaces. And, you know, I've been hooked on these lately. And another one that I frequently attend are these sort of old commodity sales dog type folks that are talking about, you know, where they see things going in terms of, you know, what amounts to, in their estimation, a, you know, bifurcation to either a bi or multipolar world, breakdown of these brittle just-in-time supply chains, which will lead to, you know, what they anticipate as being likely imminent, you know, scarcity of really key resources that will cause all sorts of potential calamity among, you know, especially, you know, I guess less wealthy demographics in the US and other countries. But just curious in terms of, you know, your thoughts on that potentiality. And I understand like these are folks that are coming with a very different set of biases, and you know, they immediately discount any thought around crypto. But it's just interesting to see their thoughts. And these are people with, you know, 30 years of experience in all kinds of markets, and it just some food for thought that I'd love to hear your opinion on.
Okay. Like specifically an element of, I'm not sure which part you wanted to address.
Yeah, just you know, in terms of in the, you know, however likely scenario that there's, you know, scarcity of commodities, whether it be, you know, certain grains, energy, steel, you know, necessary components for organized you know, life and developed society.
When you say energy, what energy are you referring to specifically?
Oil, natural gas, things like that.
Okay. I don't think oil is going anywhere in the next 50 years. That's my take on it. I'd rather not go into any more detail than that, but that's my perspective on that. Joseph,
I think what Spring is saying is like, as of this moment, we don't have a replacement for a substantial portion of technological society for long chain hydrocarbons.
Correct.
Forget about like driving around in your car and stuff. Like everything from medicine to plastic to like, there is no reasonable sort of like nanotech based alternative to assembling carbon molecules at scale into long chains outside of refining petrochemicals at this point.
Right. And so, based on petroleum in general, I don't know if any of you know this, but 40% of the world's petroleum is used in textiles, plastics, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
100%, it's not just using transportation.
Not only just transportation, but the other element that you have to consider is the fact that a substantial portion of the inputs for fertilizer essentially come from things like potash, natural gas, both of which are in reasonable scarcity, and the natural gas and the petrochemical based fertilizer and ammonia based systems essentially. Like, I think something like 9 out of 10 carbon molecules in your body today are essentially artificially fertilized carbon. And you can like carbon date your, you can do a carbon analysis on your body and find like most of your bodies, like corn or whatever in the United States, for example. But the amount of energy that goes into food inputs in the world today to manage a, you know, whatever our population today is, 6 billion plus. That's not going to really happen without the petrochemical inputs. Like without petrochemicals, like if you think you're going to go to solar panels and whatnot, that implies essentially a massive human scale die off of probably half the population, if not more, I would guess. So that may be where we're headed possibly if we don't have enough energy. So that's a whole interesting discussion just by itself. But I think Spring, were you getting at the rare earth metals and such that are, you know, in certain countries, but not others in terms of scarcity?
Yeah, what I was getting at was, you know, assuming there is a scarcity of resources that prevent people from driving their truck to work or, you know, buying even the cheapest of foodstuffs, you know, these are the sort of, you know, initial red flags, you know, preceding like French Revolution and things like that. And we already have such sort of turmoil in the, you know, stateside. So I'm curious, you know, given that there's these pretty, you know, I don't know how probabilistic, but there's the potentiality of these headwinds really significantly impacting certain demographics of the U.S. And I'm just curious about what the downstream impact would be on
the most
we love talking about.
Yeah, one of the most dangerous scenarios that could emerge out of this this sort of East Asia region is that a substantial portion, of course, of chip manufacturing, as you guys know, is in the Far East. But additionally, you have the problem of the rare earth metals that go into significant portion of chip manufacturing that come from China and, a lot of China. So if we do kind of weird shit, like, for example, cut Russia off from SWIFT, then that bludgeon can be used against us to cut us off from all sorts of things as well by China, which, you know, creates another set of circumstances. One thing I would note, I don't know if you guys noticed, this is kind of slightly off the beaten path, but if you guys noticed the recent Apple, I don't know if you watched the Apple keynote with the latest computer that was put out. Anyone see this? So the Apple's M1, you know, Max and M1 Ultra chips. Anyone follow this at all?
No.
If you haven't, I would definitely watch what these things can do. All right. Like, this is one of those ways to fight inflation. So if you're like, hey, I'm Luna rich and I got some UST off my anchor, one of the things you get yourself is get yourself a computer that can solidly last 20 years. And the current Mac M1 chips are so obnoxiously efficient with such just ridiculous computational power. I mean, you can build, like, you can create a production grade movie for, like, you know, 3-4K worth of that new M1 Ultra computer. The thing is just brute force ridiculous. But I think you're going to get a pretty good inflation hedge by buying something that can use that you can literally use for the next like 20 years pretty effectively.
Does Apple make that chip, Steffi?
Yeah, Apple's M1 is really now the really the best chip on the planet, quite frankly. There's not any company or system or anybody that builds that. And and the reason why it's amazing is because it doesn't the efficiency of the systems on a chip that they have going on right now, as far as putting all the memory for graphics, for processing, all in the same chip. And then these just ridiculously super compact and efficient systems with almost no power usage comparatively. Even Intel like released a whole series of new Bitcoin mining chips, which looks interesting as well. But there's my point is there are some things that people can do to mitigate the effect of inflation. And one of those is to secure yourself very good computational power for the next maybe 15 years in case crisis, because the cost of those things could sky the fucking rocket up. Like, those things are amazingly cheap for what they do, amazingly so. And people might want to look into.
You are talking about the studio, right?
Damn, I just went cheap with AMD chip.
Yeah, the studio is what he's talking about. Yeah, that's a much more powerful thing. But even those basic ones, my point is these things go and go and go.
They are dual M1s. They bonded together with a specific custom PCB.
I had one other totally different question, if you have time for it. So, on the topic of, and I know that we're not in the business of converting people or anything, it's more educational oriented, but my on-ramp to crypto is really the We Study Billionaires podcast. And so I thought that might be an interesting conversation to be had with I think Preston over there, because I think a lot of people in Bitcoin today might immediately be receptive to the value that Luna has to offer, and it might be an interesting community to build a relationship with.
That podcast is awesome. Preston Pish is the man for sure. Can you guys hear me okay? I was breaking up there for a little bit.
Yeah, Justin, yes. You're good now. Okay. We can hear you good. Okay. Hey, I'm going to bring up Raymar after your comment. He's been patiently waiting, and then we're going to go to...
Yeah, hold up just a second. I want to make a quick comment on Spring Snow's question about commodities before we get too far beyond that. So just really quickly, you made the comment, Spring, that, you'd been spending some time with some of the old heads in the commodity space, in some spaces with those folks. And that, I think that was kind of how you led the comment off. It's what they're looking at this and they're saying, they're not really super interested in talking about crypto, and, they want to talk about commodities and all this stuff. So it's like, The big challenge here is let's take ESG, which is a really insane idea to kind of extrapolate. But it's we're not aware of enough copper on planet Earth to take, all of the things electric that need to be taken, electric according to our strict ESG agenda. So it's you take something simple like that, something that's just so base like that. You look at how the markets are reacting to nickel. I don't know if anybody saw nickel this week, but it was insane. I mean, these things are trading like meme coins, right? And they're commodities that form, the basis of most economic activity. And so, all this is to say is we're now in a time where the concept, human beings cannot wrap their mind around what exponential growth actually means. And so we're in this place where, not only are our meat space communities, growing exponentially, not only are the challenges that come with governance, growing exponentially, but what's adding into this complexity is that the world that we live in today is super complex, and complexity demands hyper specialization, right? And so I think that we're really in this kind of, you know, awakening kind of process here where it's like, you know, like most little segments of, you know, the economy. I mean, it's like, they're not, they don't have a huge amount of, you know, you know, I guess like view or perspective or, you know, whatever on other parts of the economy that they may be connected to. So it's like, you know, now we're discovering just how interconnected this stuff is. And just like a super simple example, when COVID hit in 2020, the problem with getting PPE actually came down to the machine that makes the inside of an N95 mask, right? And let's use N95 masks specifically. So like that filter is what's known as a melt blown filter. And it's actually a pretty intensive process that material has to go through in order to become melt blown. And so the machines that make that melt blown filter are like very, very specific. And the parts for those machines was actually what the hangup was. In order to build one of these machines, it takes years to put these things together because like there's just not a need. There wasn't a need to like hyperscale melt blown filter machines or whatever. And so it's like you take that and you start looking, you know, pattern matching, you know, that super simple example just throughout the global economy. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel like we're moving into this place where like, and I'm gonna follow you because I'd love to, you know, hop into to one of those commodity spaces and just be a fly on the wall and listen. But like, you know, it's just like the interconnectivity, you know, of the world is kind of becoming apparent, and you know, the complexity that comes with that. It's like truly, I think Steffi said this a little bit earlier. You made a comment about the butterfly effect. Like truly, the egg prices in China, you know, affect something else, and like how that other thing is affected is kind of being laid bare. So where we go from here, you know, who knows? But it's just it's like, you know, in this world, like the generalists, I believe the generalists will kind of win because they're able to step back and contextualize everything. So anyway, just wanted to make that comment real quickly. I know we've got somebody that wants to ask a question.
Yeah, I got Marty back up here, and Mandiv, so we'll get to you next after Marty.
Yeah, I think history, though, says that, you know, following, you know, kind of the war, intense economic, whatever else, is that, you know, there's deglobalization. And that's actually what the situation that we're in right now is. Like, this happened after World War One, and it's happening to us now. So there's deglobalization going on. So the number of SKUs or the number of product types that are going to be available in your favorite store are going to reduce. And the number of, you know, products that are maybe more local to you, local being the US, are percentage-wise going to increase, and it's going to decrease from overseas for a lot of reasons. Now, with the Russian thing, we have two problems, or maybe three, or it boils down to, you know, food and energy. So, you know, the energy costs obviously are going to go way up, which is going to affect the logistics, and basically transporting things is not going to be as interesting. And then the food part is going to, like, we're going to see starvation in Africa. We're going to see heavy malnutrition in South America, because they are the biggest exporter of nitrate-based fertilizers that make those really interesting carbons that go into your body, ultimately through, you know, this food system that we have. So it's going to be really, really interesting. Less mangoes and more red beets.
Green mangoes, or you like the more ripe mangoes? Which ones you prefer?
Well, I like mango puree because I really like cocktails. But I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, this whole we source from the entire, you know, globe is going to go way down, even for the United States. But, you know, I'm not sure exactly what Steffi was trying to say. But I'll tell you one, when I
saw your point is that getting your crap from Mexico or whatever if you're in the US, for example, is going to cost substantially more just to ship that stuff in.
And when he was talking about the M1, I was cognizant of the M1 launch. The thing I thought, Seffy, was, man, I got to buy one of those before they become incredibly scarce and never be able to get one, you know, next year kind of thinking.
Yeah, I was waiting because like year after year, I was kind of waiting for the specific technology to sort of emerge and then swap out my desktop and other crap. And it's just kind of a pain in the ass to move all my stuff. So I'm like, all right, let's just kind of wait. But yeah, but my point is that if you look back at my like Mac that I bought in maybe 2014 as a good example, and it still works to this day, like it's when the Retina style display came out, you know, with the super high, you know, resolution. I've never felt like I had to go buy another one since then because it works so well. And so there's these like epoch making sort of designs that emerge. And if you think about it, like the value I got out of that one piece of hardware since 2014 till now, it's a remarkable amount of use of the utility of the money that was spent getting it, right? So there are sometimes things you can do that in your personal life that like combats inflation that involves just getting, you know, more of the shit while it's cheap. In other words, like, for example, the last several years, like I typically would buy like, you know, whatever our favorite soap is, I would buy like this massive box of it. Like, so there's this attic full of soap. I shit you not. I haven't gone to buy soap in like years. Not because I'm a prepper or some shit, but it's just because it's a good, like, it's just a, well, I don't have to go shopping, number one. Number two, like, you can get it cheap. You know, and I use like all sorts of like crypto rewards programs to buy a whole bunch of shit, dumped it all off and stuck it in my attic. And now I don't have to go shopping for that stuff. When there was that toilet paper craze, that was hilarious. I have this massive amount of space. So I always have like a ton of all the commodities that I need all just sitting there. And it sounds weird, but like all that stuff has gone up in price. You know, like, My commodities and the stuff that I use is basically outperformed the general market to some extent. It's kind of hilarious.
Seppi, are you an Irish Spring guy?
Actually, I have become an Irish Spring guy. How did you know?
Great minds think alike.
I kid you not. You know where I got my. Here's where I got my Irish Spring from. This is hilarious. The Stormex app, the Stormex.io, I think it is, or whatever, Stormex. They have this like rewards program, and if you have a whole bunch of coins, then you can get like a lot of cashback rewards using your you know Stormex app. And so they had this like deal with, I don't remember, like Kroger or something. And it was like 22% cash back or 24% cash back. And then on top of that, the credit card cash back or whatever. So I'm like, okay, that's good. Let me just go get a bunch of soap and all the other crap that I need. I don't like shopping anyway. You know, shaving razors, all the garbage, you know, you don't want to go every day for. And I just bought a whole bunch of shit all at once. And Irish Spring was actually one of them. And I've never been an Irish Spring person until that moment. And for some reason, I clicked the button that got me a shit ton of Irish Spring. And I kind of like the soap now. So anyway.
Hey, I'm going to bring up Mandivs real quick. I think he had a question or comment. And then we're going to go to Sanjeev.
No, I don't have any question. I was just trying to get that comment from Seffy about M1, M2. So here's what I did. So I introduced a friend to Luna last year, and he made a deal like every $50,000, I'll give you $1,000. And it's okay. So, and he put like $200,000 in Luna. And then it's right now, depending on the price, I think we agreed like, okay, by December, I should get 10,000 worth of any item I want. And then we agreed to buy MacBook Pro, and actually not MacBook Pro, iMac Pro, the one with the, they call the cheese shredder. And then I saw like, okay, he went to like a vacation or something. And he said, once I come back, I'll get it to you. So he's not written back yet. But then I saw this Apple event. So and I said, okay, I changed my mind. Yeah, I changed my mind. Now I'm going with M2 Studio.
Hey, well, TTLG is accepting any Mac donations.
There you go.
Yeah. So, Sanjeev, so we're gonna go ahead and bring you up, man. Thanks, Matt Deves. We'll catch up with you, man.
Hey, thanks, TTLG. Hey, Sefi, I have two questions for you. You know, first one is, I think, you know, I keep reading these Doquan, you know, messages, right? He says curve is unbalanced. So can you explain in simple terms what does it mean? You know, what curve? Is it yield curve? I don't get it. And I think you know it. And that's one. Second part, you know, this is your definition, right? You say Luna is deflationary asset with non-inflationary yields. So how is it deflationary? Because, you know, we keep pumping, increasing circulating supply, right? And analogically, if I were to compare that with the stock, when they increase the float, obviously it has implications on the, you know, price of the stock, right? And this keeps happening because, and so in that case, and the third example can be that chains like AVAX or DOT, they also do the same thing, but in their case, they're basically paying, you know, the people who are staking, right, those rewards. And Luna doesn't need to do that, but our use case, I think, is, you know, different, right? To maintain the peg or, you know, we are basically pumping it. But in that sense, then, you know, I don't understand it. So if you can explain it, you know, it'll help everyone, I think.
Joseph, you want to, should we go to this subject or you guys have some other like direction you're trying to hit with today's discussion?
No, that would be awesome. If you want to.
Yeah, probably a worthwhile conversation. Yeah. So, yeah, the deflationary aspect, number one, we're talking about the tokenomics, essentially. The fact that basically the more Luna is used to create UST, you burn it, right? But that doesn't mean that in this instance, Terraform Labs doesn't happen to have a pretty sizable chunk of Luna. And fortunately, as opposed to just arbitrarily sort of dumping on the market, which they could if they wanted to, I suppose, it's up to them in that sense. That's a negative feature of the token distribution as it stands. But the good news is they have been using that for the good of the community, either directly or indirectly, by either fueling the Anchor Reserve, by burning Luna to UST, or selling the Luna to specific groups of individuals who have to tie it up in smart contracts that vest over like a year and 4 years and things like that. So that has resulted in kind of like this buying pressure, and it has built up this sort of Bitcoin reserve for the LFG and whatnot, as you've heard already. The idea that, yeah, circulating supply can continue to theoretically increase if TFL decides to sell Luna directly on the market, that is true. It can happen. And for that matter, if people unstake, that can happen too. That's why the number to be watchful of is the total supply of Luna, which is in this currently in the 760 million Luna range right now. That's a more pure picture of where we are in terms of overall deflation, overall supply. But that number does not reflect on the market cap, which tends to be affected by the circulating supply, the way like CoinMarketCap and CoinGecko and whatnot report it, right? So you're right, like more coins can come into the market, but in this instance, a majority of that Luna is either being locked up in specific types of longer-term sales, or it is being burned to UST, which is good for us. So it hasn't been problematic in any meaningful way, Sanjeev, as far as like the overall direction of deflation, and because most of that Luna is not just being dumped on the market. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I think I kind of get it now. Can you also explain, you know, because I don't understand it, when they say curve is unbalanced, can you explain that?
Forgot about that. Yeah. Well, if you have any AMM, you know, money market, basically you have, you know, two-sided pools. You've seen these things, like, for example, on Astroport, for example. Like, let's say you have Luna and bonded Luna. And what happens if there is a high demand for bonded Luna? The amount of bonded Luna in the pool, you know, gets used up, right? And then you see that the discounts for bonded Luna go away. On the other hand, if there are more sellers of B Luna, then you notice that it's like available at a discount to you if you want to arbitrage it, right? You've seen this sort of effect. Similarly on Curve, if you take UST, you compare it to other stable coins, UST has been in high demand, whether it's for use in like leaving Ethereum and going to Anchor Protocol, or, you know, whatever reasons it's in demand. Maybe people just want decentralized stablecoin. Whatever the reason may be, the Curve pool doesn't have enough UST in it. So it's has been trading above peg, meaning like if you go and take an Anchor borrow and you look at Curve and you go, hey, look, the cost of UST there is $1.01. And you go on Anchor and you get yourself some UST by borrowing off of your Luna, right? You could take that UST, get it over to Ethereum, and you could sell it for a penny more than what it is actually worth. And then you could sit and wait until UST peg goes down to 1.0 again, and then get it back, and then bring it back to Terra, and then pay off your loan, right? So you can do these kind of neat tricks to arbitrage that difference. But that's what they mean by the Curve pool is imbalanced. And Curve being a pretty sizable DEX, obviously, it has a significant economic impact because of the sheer size of Curve and the sheer size of the Ethereum network compared to other DEXs and centralized exchange pools that have UST. So that's kind of the deal. So it just simply means Curve doesn't have enough UST. And in order to have that go down, you have to actually burn Luna to generate UST. In fact, even if we just simply borrow UST from Anchor, that doesn't actually, that actually makes even more Luna burn indirectly, in a sense, in the background, because Anchor has to replete its reserve of UST, right? So you contribute to the burn either way, no matter how you arb this, whether you borrow for it or whether you yourself just burn Luna to UST and go play the arb and then bring the money back. So that's the story.
All great points, Steffi. I want to, Sanjeev, I just want to bring up the fact we did discuss with Steffi on one of our episodes, Big Ideas with Steffi, about the TFL burning mechanism. So if you want to check that out, it's available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. And there's also timestamps for that as well. So you can scroll through that real quick. Did you have another question? I'm going to bring Draco next.
Yeah, I think one more question I had for Steffi. Steffi, I've been following your tweets, right? So you talk about deterministic price. And so I get it with Luna because, you know, I mean, it's a productized suite, right? It's the best product basically available in crypto right now. I mean, we are seeing large adoption, which will lead to, you know, token growth adoption and stuff, and which will ultimately, you know, make it more scarce with the burns which are happening. So price goes up. I'm not sure. So if you added two more things now, Thorchain and Prism, can you talk about in that? Because I think you're now basically saying that there is a use for those assets as well. And, you know, I think you're thinking that those will basically go, you know, huge, maybe 10x, right, in some time.
Yeah, so the realization I think that the crypto space is making in terms of tokenomics, number one, because obviously Luna's proven it as the largest deterministic market cap at this point. I think the deterministic pricing of a token is almost a compulsory feature of all tokens now, and there's not even a point of buying anything that doesn't have this. And so I'm going to be fairly like that's sort of my explicit feeling at this point. I don't think there's any other way to slice this bread. If you don't have a deterministic price model, meaning some of your coin actually leaves circulation as a result of using it, or some return on investment to the shareholder of the coin comes back every time someone uses it, similar to like a dividend, or both, right? If you can get elements of multiple incentives, like yield from the network, which Luna gives you in the form of the seigniorage, right, with the burns, and then also the token supply being modulated by its usage. Why is that so important? If you think about it, all you have to look at is the actual rate of a token supply going down to know how much activity is happening on that particular network, right? Think about that really carefully. You don't need any fancy metrics. You don't need like Glassnode to tell you about Bitcoin. You don't need any of that shit. Anyone can tell you that people are using a network because supply is going down, period, end of story. And that's extremely powerful. It's easy to memeify, as you guys have noticed, and it's easy for anyone to look at it and go, okay, I can see something's happening here. You know, okay, the burns are happening. There must be adoption. Someone's using this stuff or whatever, right? And I think the deterministic model, if you can't build that into a token economy, then I have to ask an important, question you have to ask yourself. Maybe that entire coin is bullshit. Maybe there's no utility for the damn thing. Because if you can't build a deterministic price model, I was thinking about this when I was looking at other coins and going, wait a minute, like, could you build a deterministic price model for these other possible coins in the world? If you can't create a deterministic model, there's probably something wrong with whatever project you're talking about, that it doesn't really have the economic activity necessary to build one. And that means it's probably going to zero at some point in the future. Like this realization kind of hit me like a ton of bricks going, wait a minute, like this isn't just a coincidence that Luna's doing as well as it is. You have to have a deterministic pricing model. Otherwise, you're not really getting a great, a great Web3 asset. And once, you know, you realize, wait a minute, this deterministic price model is so easy to understand. You don't need like freaking analysts and CNBC and all this other garbage to figure out what's going on. Then you realize, wait a minute, like all stocks should be have a deterministic price model, such that when you go and buy an Apple computer, you should basically pay for it and burn some of the Apple stock that is in circulation, right? It's almost like, so in other words, don't think of it like stocks like we do now. A deterministic tokenomic essentially means that the you have to use the coin and destroy it, similar to how you would like a ticket to a concert, right? You go to a concert, you know, you use it one time and it's done. That's it, right? It's almost like an NFT style situation. But if you destroy the coin when you use it, there's no situation in which, like, longer term, it can really be manipulated. It does tend to make the rich richer, though, because if you're early to the game and you hold a lot of it, then you tend to do really well. But then again, if you keep burning, the newcomers don't get screwed by just arbitrary inflation either. And that continues to benefit the new person that invests in Luna today. So, for example, if I buy Luna today, which I did, then I'm not any worse off for doing so than having bought Luna at, you know, $4 to $5, which I did also, right? So in other words, I'm not getting screwed by being late to the party. That would be more of the signal of a true like Ponzi or something like that, or just some pyramid scheme or something along those lines. So I think that this tokenomic model probably should be the nature of all future models. And there's that one company called Fan Fury, I believe, that we interviewed like last week, and they're doing like fantasy sports gaming, like, you know, like fantasy football, fantasy, I think they're going to do fantasy cricket and fantasy basketball, whatever, you know what I'm talking about, the fantasy sports concept. And what they're going to do is, the token that goes to their particular project, every time someone plays one of these games, it results in burning of the token involved with like the project. And that they basically said, well, we just duplicated the Luna UST model, Luna being our primary token, but call it Fan Fury token or whatever. And then the product being the actual playing of the game, that sort of that burns the token and leads to supply reduction over time, so that you benefit the holder of this coin, right? So whatever your product is, it should be not only just paid for with that coin, but that coin should be destroyed as a function of using that product. It's an extremely powerful model, and it prevents having to have any like weird metrics to figure out how your economy is doing. It's really interesting.
That's all great points on tokenomics, Seffy. I appreciate you bringing that up. We've actually talked about the burning mechanism and with Luna specifically over the course of 8 days, given Luna's burning 1.5 million tokens every day, that's essentially a 3% return on your Luna tokens over the course of 8 days, given the liquid circulating supply. So I just want to bring that to light. We've talked about that in plenty of episodes. Drake, I know you have a question. I want to bring you up real quick. What do you have, man? Drake, you there?
Yeah, snap. Yeah, I'm here. I was trying to unlock my phone. It locked on me, and I was like, oh, geez. I must have died. But yeah, no, I highly agree to or plus one to what Sefi just said about tokenomics-wise. And just remember this day. We're going to have a bunch of Luna forks, so just be careful. Sefi, just wanted to follow up with you, man. Did you take a look at Frax?
No, not at all. Not yet.
Dude, you knew it was coming, man.
I had work today, so I've got my partners that are out on vacations, and I was sort of busy during the day. I haven't had time to do anything. I just chatted. Yeah, I just jumped on here late.
Oh, yeah. I feel you on that, man. Yeah, it's tough. But yeah, that was the biggest thing I wanted to ask you. If anyone in this space wants to hear a bit about Frax, if not, we could save it for another time. It sounded like you guys were in a rush. I'm not shilling Frax. I just wanted to explain it and then hear your thoughts on it, because it's an interesting concept. And what's interesting is Luna is actually starting to take on the Frax model, being that they're starting to bring in assets like Bitcoin. You remember the classic saying, all roads lead to Frax?
Yeah, the difference in particular for Luna is that the BTC sort of ARB mechanism is not really required to be there. It's something that was largely brought about as a way to simply take one outcome was that you could use TFL's funds to sort of bolster the system just because they have all this money, and you know, what are they going to do with it exactly? The second reason is because that way you can combat the FUD regarding, wait, what is this backed by? And you say, oh, hey, LFG is in the background there, and they're going to have a money market that can help with the peg anytime it's needed, additional to you know, any other mechanisms that you might have. Because right now the problem is that the UST burn rate is actually maxed out. The protocol actually only allows for so much so that you don't have too much reflexivity all at one time and people gaming and scamming the system. So there's like a max amount of UST per day that can essentially minted from Luna. As a result, what the LFG can do is they can basically take you know, get UST into the market quicker to bring the peg down if needed. But more importantly, their primary goal is to prevent UST depeg to the downside so that they can be a buyer if necessary. And eventually the goal would be that money markets would just take care of that automatically. So if you have a large enough money market, like Vertex protocol becomes really big, you should not need necessarily some kind of central agency to do this. People will do it automatically, just like people do on the Forex now. And that's the longer term vision of the way that the UST peg is intended to be maintained.
Okay, yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And I appreciate you breaking that down a bit. Also, one other thing I want to add to that is Frax can go fully algo just like Luna. So it's an interesting concept, because like I mentioned to you earlier, or not earlier, but like a couple days ago, the Frax model allows the market to say how much is algo based on market demand. So like if the market is like, hey, we need more Frax, like as in there's too much collateral, so let's go ahead and juice it up and start printing. That's like the type of model that they have. So like as more and more Frax is printed, less and less collateral is backing it. So if more people are like, oh wait, whoa, we don't have enough collateral, we need to like chill, cool this down, what you can do is you can burn the Frax, and this adds more collateral, because now you're burning the funny money that was there, which is the FXS token, similar to like Luna and UST. Luna would be considered your funny money, because it's just a created algo coin that people see as having a value. And I agree, it does actually have it. Not I agree that it doesn't have value. I think it does have value. I see the value in it. But in reality, it is the algo coin that is being used to measure the growth of UST. So as UST growth increases, you will see it in the Luna price and tokenomics, because Luna is being burned in exchange for the UST. So that's kind of what I was getting at with Luna starting to grab Bitcoin. And it's going to be an interesting thing that's going to happen with...
The way you can think about it is UST is essentially a form of Luna. It's really just it's a wrapped
form of Luna.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead, Steffi.
Now, say like Luna is UST is essentially kind of a wrapped form of Luna. It's like imagine you just transform it into a slightly different form and back and forth. So really,
Luna lurks. I love Luna. Like,
no, I'm just saying for the audience, not for you so much. But that basically you're talking about, and really the total market cap of UST and Luna is the total value of both, in a sense. Although technically speaking, you know, the fully to Sanjeev's point, like the fully diluted market cap or full market cap includes whatever actual TFL funds are locked up, and why those aren't actually included in the total market cap, I'm not sure. Actually, it's a weird distinction that's made there in how CoinMarketCap and whatnot does its metrics.
I don't know if Do Kwon realizes or TFL realizes, like, they can literally pump the market if they wanted to. I'm just saying what they can do, like they did, as you saw a couple days ago, starting to pump the Bitcoin price. Not a couple days, but maybe like a week ago. But literally, Luna can buy Bitcoin, pump the price of Bitcoin, which further pumps the price of altcoins, and maybe other protocols will start buying Bitcoin as well. Which will pump the price of Bitcoin more, which will pump their altcoins, so then they could buy more Bitcoin and just kind of like boom, boom, boom. And even better, you can get more advanced. Is, you know how Thorchain has the every $1 in, $3 to the Rune market cap? Rune could be like the ultimate facilitator of this, because if you have $1 coming into the system, you automatically get $3 in market cap, which juices the Rune token price. So what Rune can do is go out there and buy other assets, bring it into Thorchain, and juice the whole system. I hope some people like realize like we have the ultimate flywheel, but yeah, dude, it's gonna be interesting.
It's an extremely strange flywheel, and the purchasing power of TFL's Luna, or even for that matter, the community pool's Luna, which I think still sits at like a billion.
Ah, forget the Luna, dude. Worth. Just burn the Luna.
No, that's what I'm saying. But the purchasing power of it could pump like literally like hundreds of coins simultaneously, just arbitrarily. It's just a matter of like, depending on how, like, if let's say the community decides, you know what, we're going to buy the top 100 cryptos and we're going to buy like, you know, 10 million of each or something like that. Right.
You could basically juice the whole market. Do it with UST.
Yeah, of course.
Juice your own coin.
Of course.
Dude, it's a win-win-win.
Yeah, it's a strange flywheel effect for sure.
Don't need to pamp it, man. All right, I'm done.
Hey, Drake, how deep are you in Frax?
Dude, I'm in all the algos, man. I've even been Shield Haven. I finally got finished researching it. Like, I made a thread on some of the flywheel. I've been mentioning it, but I added the Thorchain to the flywheel to it. I was tweeting about it today, but like, I like all these stable coins, man. I understand the value of it. I even went with another stable coin called Vader Protocol. I realized like some of these stable coins are going to get completely and utterly wrecked. But if you throw the darts at enough places, those ones that you throw darts at that end up being winners, they're going to pay for the losers. Like Luna, I bought Luna at 50 cents. So I don't care. I mean, I bought Frax at $2 or FXS. I don't care. It pays for the loser. I mean, sure, I even played in the Iron Finance Algo Ponzi. I didn't get utterly wrecked, but yeah, I got wrecked. But, I mean, just stuff like that. It's like fun. But yeah, dude, yeah. I love Frax. What you want to know about it?
You've taken plenty of risks is what you're saying over time.
Okay, so it's risk that is calculated. So like,
of course, yeah, your allocations.
Say I have $100,000. Well, I'm not investing any more than 10%. So like, I still have the 90 G's if I lose all that 10 G's. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. You're using like sane allocation of extreme growth assets and then just sort of like letting them play out, basically.
Yeah, and then let Anchor, the 20% yield, pay for my losses.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Hey, so appreciate the question, Drake. Let me just re-steer the conversation here just a bit. I think we got time for like one more question. Sefi, would love your opinion on this. The Polychain ARCA proposal on Anchor, what are your thoughts on that? There was a lot of action around that this week in the community.
Which proposal? You're talking about the one with yeah, the recent one that got rejected, or?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was a Polychain / ARCA proposal on Anchor that was suggesting that the yield should be stratified based on you know how much capital you've got in Anchor Earn. I don't know. Did you see all this? The big dust up on Twitter, and I mean, my yeah. God, like.
So so what happens is, number one, the proposal is not really workable. It reflects a misunderstanding on a mixture of problems like how smart contracts work, how Anchor works, how protocols are built on top of Anchor. A lot of things are wrong with the proposal. It's not even a point in getting too deep into the weeds with it. But it also doesn't end up solving much of the problems that, you know, people think it's going to solve anyway. So it's not a comprehensive solution. You know, my view on the fix of Anchor would be, you know, traditionally a bank, if you deposit money with them and they're going to provide you some yield, the depositor actually has to take some risk in the sense that the yield is not A, guaranteed, but B, on top of that, the bank itself is using your money to go invest in something and then earn some yield and pay you, right? Or something like that, in theory. So if Anchor had a revenue stream outside of just the proof of stake yields from borrowers, then I think you could make a more sustainable situation. So that's but that's a whole nother discussion. The protocol, the reason why some people are suspicious about this whole thing was so a significant portion of vote went to the yes vote, but the prior week, you know, because Anchor's price has been pumping, there has been suspiciously I think Pappy noted, or somebody did, or Vlad or Pappy, one of the two,
it was Pappy. You're right.
Well, noted that there were only a few like wallets or whatever buying up all this ANK token and pumping the price. And it's not clear if the proposal / vote and all this other shenanigans going around it, whether or not there is some sort of market manipulation going on in that scheme as well. So I don't know for sure. Like, I'm not sitting there looking at the on-chain analysis and whatnot to really delve into it. So I'm not going to say yay or nay to whether that's true or not. But that was what, you know, people are wondering might be happening. I know Pappy and I think Midas and some, you know, were getting kind of like pissy about it because they're like, hey, this looks like a attempt to game the system in some way. And that's the problem with these governance voting systems is, there are some ways to sort of just price manipulate things. I'm not even saying that's exactly what happened. Again, so I don't want to like throw shade on the people that threw the proposal because I don't know for sure. But it is a possible attack vector, and it has been used before to manipulate prices and do different things. So that's interesting. But yeah, the proposal that they provided was not realistic. It's not implementable in a meaningful way. Who was it, Cedric or Pappy was mentioning the fact that you could just simply take a huge chunk of TFL, you know, money, buy some coin that emits some yield like bonded ETH or bonded Atom or something, and then just take that yield and fuel the yield reserve with that for, you know, extended period of time will help also. And he's right. I mean, that's, you know, just basically taking the yields from other chains, simply loading up on those. And I mentioned this almost, it's almost been like 9 months when Doe and, you know, the rest of us were sort of chatting about this Bitcoin money market concept. You know, one of the theories I had was at the time to get a basket of proof of stake assets that we deem sufficiently strong enough and basically take the yield from those and fuel the community pool, or maybe, and then you could use that same concept to fuel the anchor reserve to some extent. In other words, not borrowers, but literally anchor itself is a DAO and it has assets and it's actually generating revenue that can effectively fuel elements of the yield reserve. But no matter what, it's the yield reserve can't stay super high forever, because what happens if 100 million people come and start borrowing off of there, right? You're going to deplete it no matter what. So you would have to have some productive activity that Anchor does outside of just simply lending. Because as what's his name, Pedro said, you're always going to have way more people that are interested in the earn side than the borrow side. There's just mathematically, that's just mathematically obvious. And how to handle that is not really clear. This is why I don't rely on my future income from Terra. I don't rely on Anchor Protocol UST at all personally. All of my strategies are to get yield via Luna, which has a known L1 yield function. And I can diversify in theory if new L1s show up that are really solid. I can theoretically get some of those and get those yields. But I don't think I'm of the camp that the there's no way in the mathematical universe that Anchor earned yield can last forever. So anyway, that's kind of the theory there.
Hey, Sefi, I got a quick question for you. When you're talking, you mentioned that the anchor yield will be pulling say for example, staked Atom. It's earning like 15% yield, and obviously it's over collateralized, so it'll be able to sustain the 20%. But still, the 20% is not sustainable, in my opinion, even with that. But
exactly, it'll get us further. Than just simply burning Luna to UST and then dumping that UST into the pool.
Yeah.
Compared to if you were to buy Bonded Atom with it, for example, and dump that into a reserve and then take the yield off of that.
Yeah, that was the main thing I was kind of curious of. I don't know if you're in any other assets like AVAX or Solana or Cosmos, or even like BE, being that the way the Anchor protocol is set up, I'm just curious if it gets large enough, or at least big enough compared to other assets or ecosystems, it seems like it's siphoning money from them, at least.
Exactly.
So like, what do you think, like how would other protocols look at that?
This is why I've been saying all along that layer ones with inflationary yields can't survive in a world where there's a layer of money. Well, they can't survive in a world where there's a deflationary yield driver like Luna, because ultimately what will happen is people use the yield from inflationary tokens to put them in a store of value like Bitcoin, or put them into something, right? So the apex asset always gets the final, it becomes a magnet, right? And that's the problem. So exactly what you're describing is why I think, to some extent, Doe did not decide to acquire other layer ones as part of the, what do you call it, the LFG reserve thus far. If they decide to do that, like let's say they were to bring in some, they actually acquire some of those assets for the reserve pools, for the yield. I think that they'll do it more for the meme effect of, hey, this is a handshake between us and Solana. This is a handshake between us and Avalanche. But you're right. Like the yield is actually leaving that ecosystem in a sense. And it's being sold and creating constant selling pressure for those inflationary assets, right? That's the problem.
Yeah, because it's almost like one of the auto compounding vaults like you deal with.
Exactly. See, and this is why it's important for people to play in all the different types of dApps, is because then you really start understanding the mechanics and the problems that will emerge eventually. But you're right. You're exactly right. The auto compounding vaults are like a vampire on those kinds of yields that were meant to be inflationary yields to benefit the holder by mitigating some volatility risk and, like, you know, paying you for your time in the system. But instead, what you're doing is you're selling it to buy something else, which is where the problem comes in.
So what are your thoughts on a mixed asset then? Something like, when I say mixed asset, I mean Ethereum. Like, inflationary rewards really aren't that bad. They actually make it sustainable. Bitcoin really does have an issue. Like, when the Bitcoin rewards get to a certain point, they're really low. I know some are saying the fees will sustain. I mean, dude, if it's digital gold, I don't go to the grocery store to go buy a gallon of milk with my gold. I just don't. Like, it just sits in the safe and I don't care about it. It doesn't move.
But this is why Luna wins, right? Because you have UST for that purpose.
Yeah,
but so you not only have the deflator,
but like you still need to do smart contracts, and you don't need to, but still people are going to want to do that. So that's why I still see the value in other smart contract layers. So I mean, like, what about an asset like ETH that it actually does have negative inflation for now at least? Do you think that is still sustainable?
I think what ends up happening is that you end up continuing to flow money into the most deflationary standard of the day. So in this case, at this moment, it's just like a big black hole, basically. It's the same way Bitcoin was a black hole on the balance sheet of, you know, of the planet. Luna sort of became similar in that regard. But with more network flywheels and more network effects and more exponential growth drivers. And so, yeah, this is the problem I keep, you know, the same problem that we see with, like, that Terra Alts might have competing against Luna. Other layer ones can be considered.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, it is happening. It's happening now. In fact, it happened today. I took my Atom and I have yield coming off it, and I literally bought Luna with it when on the dip, right? Because, like, why not? Because comparatively, Atom was stagnant. Luna took a drop compared to previous value. I got some. The ARB rate was awesome. So I not only got some Luna, but I also converted that to bonded Luna. I got another 2.5% extra or whatever, and then set that to burn, right? That was just free money from the Atom, the Cosmos network, that now just entered the Terra network. But I didn't go the other way around. Like, every time I think to myself, you know what? Maybe I'll send some of my UST yield over to Osmosis, and I'm going to get myself more Atom to stake it instead to get the 15% yield, which seems juicy, right? But the problem is the coin appreciation isn't going to happen. So I might as well get the yield from Luna and get the growth potential, right? So the money's going to flow in one direction, but not the other direction. And this is the problem. Imagine when bonded Atom and bonded AVAX and whatnot come to Terra. So number one, are you going to buy those things? Like, I don't buy bonded ETH at this point, right? I just get bonded Luna and I don't even mess with the ETH part. Am I going to go buy bonded AVAX? Am I going to go buy bonded Atom? Maybe if I'm going to do some kind of rebalance or arbitrage bot or something to take advantage of volatility, but I'm not going to buy it just to hold the damn thing, right? Like, why would I? I might as well just buy Luna at that point. But other people coming onto Terra who want to borrow off of their Avalanche and Solana, whatever, what are they going to buy with it? So they go and they borrow off Anchor with their collateral. They can obviously go do whatever with that money. You know, they can give up their yield and they can go take their UST and do whatever they want. But you can be damn well sure some significant portion of that is going to be to go into buying Luna. And because what are you going to realize? It's just like you did, Drake, like you just said. Like, you realize eventually, like, wait a minute, why would I want to take this money that I'm getting from other systems? And why would I want to go buy something else with it? I might as well just get more Luna. And that's what ends up happening.
Hey, yeah, no, that's quick question. Seffy, I've got a role, and I think Ryan does also. Do you want to take this room over, or are we done for the night?
Actually, I'm in the same boat as you guys. I've got a jet here, so it's been fun hanging out.
Yeah, if
you, Seffy, next question, I want to leave this question for you, so that way next Twitter space you can answer it. First, don't forget to look into Frax. But second, what if you're wrong? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying, think on that. Like, I'm a Luna Maxi man. I'm asking for my bag's sake. but I mean, like, what if you're wrong? That's all I want to
Definitely,
yeah, definitely always possible.
Don't bite, dude. It's going to be another hour. No,
it's always possible. I could be completely wrong. Yeah.
Hey, so everybody that's in the room, we've got a couple people that are requested, have questions and are requested. If you guys want to connect with somebody that's up here and route that question back through, we'll make sure. Actually, I'm going to follow you, Brian, and share. And that way, when we have another spaces, we can bring y'all up first thing. But everybody, it's been real. Everybody, keep your head on straight. And yeah, buy Luna. Do the right thing. We'll see you guys in the Cryptoverse.
Yeah, thanks everybody for tuning in tonight. We appreciate it. This is all the time we got for tonight. So thanks for listening. Go ahead and check out our latest episode with Sefi on TTLG. Great insights from Sefi, as always. Thank you, Sefi. And we'll be obviously doing a spaces in the future. So be on the lookout for that. And we'll see you guys on the interwebs. Thank you.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was part two of a two-part space, The World is Burning and So is Luna, hosted by Through the Looking Glass, recorded on Friday, March 11th, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by Luart. Luart is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. Luart provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. This episode of The Ether was also brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra, and it's the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol, and it's refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes and check them out online at WeFund.app. This episode of The Ether was also brought to you by Glow Yield. Glow Yield is the ecosystem of Terra decentralized apps like Lotto and Creators, all powered by DeFi Yields. Glow Creators helps artists and influencers give their fans exclusive perks through membership, NFTs, and more. Glow Lotto is a PrizeLink savings account with a weekly chance to win the big jackpot. Tickets are free and perpetual, which means there's zero chance to lose money. Be sure to follow Glow Yield on Twitter and join the Discord community to stay up to date with all the glowing projects and check them out online at glowyield.com. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. In the darkest of times, when the phoenix arises out of the ashes like some burned up papyrus, open the sarcophagus and release the virus. Got a lump in your throat like tonsillitis. When the flags go up like everyone is righteous, spending government checks, sniffing up the white dust. The previous generation wants to be just like us. Fuck that shit, I'm trying to be like Mike was. Drop the bias and you might survive this. The mummy coming through to remind your highness. I might just buy up my own fucking island, build a little bunker, then wait for the timer. Countdown to zero, day exploiting. Every exploit in your internet sex toys, intermittent vibrations through the ether. Did you just come? Me either. If you look at the bright side, we're lost at the right time, blindly following stars in the night sky. Part of me might ride away with the prize fight, man versus everything else until the time's right. Unleash the Kraken, no wait, that was crack. Fuck, now everybody feeling all amped up, fucking like bunnies to the national anthem. Ugly little shits eating up all our rhythm, mishandling the captions, who has the answer, holding our attention for ransom. Fed up with all the red tape and the boring template, like it matters if it's a blue or red state. Charged every month and we can't even cancel. Feeling distressed? Fuck it, kill the damsel. Fuck yeah, spread it like we're on some undead shit and pass the bitch around like a meme from Reddit.
In the beginning, it was suggested that the mortality rate would be 5% and the numbers are so much higher.
We're not ready for the the next epidemic.
And so if your oxygen level falls too low and it cannot be kept up with just what we call nasal cannulas or rebreathing oxygen masks, if you can't get enough oxygen from that, then they will intubate the patient.
Spaces.
The world is burning and you're so beautiful, baby. That's all I could think of when I read that. I'm sorry.